it's time to begin. Welcome to all you early risers. This session is section 313, Winter Richards and Nauvoo Polygamy, 1841-1842. Our presenter today is Devery Anderson, and he's quite a well-known author by now, or editor. He's edited or co-edited three very significant books in church history. One on temple worship, the other one on Joseph Smith, Quorum of the Anointed, yeah. And Nauvoo Endowment Company. By the way, these books are available at Benchmark Books. Then he has also published in Dialogue, General Mormon Thought, and General Mormon History, Sunstone, and the Southern Quarter. He's finishing the first comprehensive work on the racially motivated murder of Emmett Till in Mississippi in 1955. And is also writing. Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Also, I was going to wait till I read this, but that's okay. I think I'm about through. Writing the biography of Willard Richards, and he's a graduate in history. Thank you. At the University of Utah, and he is currently ebook editor at Signature Books and lives in Salt Lake City. Besides that, he helps out at Benchmark Books once in a while. We are pleased to have Michael Quinn be the respondent, and everybody knows Michael, that he was a professor of history at BYU for 12 years, after which he became an independent scholar. He has authored more than 80 articles and 6 books on Mormon history, and as one of the September 6th, he is renowned for contributions to the field of Mormon studies. So we're glad to have both these people here today, and we'll start with Debbie.
Maybe a little higher. Getting blind in the middle. Can you hear me okay? All right. In August 1842, Willard Richards was busy fulfilling several assignments in New York when he sent a letter to Joseph Smith by way of Apostle Orson Pratt, who was about to leave for Nauvoo. The letter reveals Richards' feelings toward and relationship with the man he revered as a prophet. I improve the few moments I can spare from previous engagements in apologizing for any neglect in not writing before this, to him whom I esteem the dearest on earth, and whose absence I continually feel, wrote Richards tenderly, but be assured that neither time nor distance can obliterate those emotions of love, of friendship, of attachment to yourself and the cause you have espoused, which are interwoven with my very existence and which grow stronger and stronger every day. Earlier that day, Richards had met with James Arlington Bennett, proprietor of Long Island's Arlington House. Bennett, writing Smith 1 week later on August 16th, referenced that visit of Richards. Your polite and friendly note was handed to me a few days since by Dr. Willard Richards, whom I must say is a very fine specimen of the Mormon people, if they are all like him. And indeed, I think him a very excellent representative of yourself, as I find he is your most devoted admirer and true disciple. He spent 2 days with me, and from his arguments and from his mild and gentlemanly demeanor, almost made me a Mormon. It was 1 year earlier to the day that Willard Richards first arrived in Nauvoo, Illinois, where his intimate bond with Smith was shortly formed. Richards' close association with Smith ended only with Smith's death 3 years later. Historian Richard Bushman noted that Richards virtually shadowed Joseph throughout the closing years of Smith's life. This shadowing culminated in Richards accompanying the prophet to Carthage Jail, where Richards witnessed the martyrdom of June 27, 1844, and shortly after he wrote the official account of the murders of Joseph and Hiram Smith. Richards' arrival in Nauvoo followed a 4-year mission to England, where he was called to the apostleship in 1838 and ordained 2 years later. It was on this mission where he met and married Janetta. Her maiden name was Richards. Janetta, who suffered continually from ill health and was bedridden much of the time, found the trip to America almost too much to bear. Willard left his wife along with the couple's son, Heber John, in Richmond, Massachusetts, in the care of Willard's siblings. He went on to Nauvoo with plans to retrieve his family the following spring. When he arrived at the Mormon headquarters on August 16, 1841, the city was approaching a population of 3,500. Shortly after Richards' arrival in Nauvoo, he was sent to Warsaw, Illinois, where to serve as land agent for a square mile tract Joseph Smith renamed Warren, after Calvin Warren, one of its owners, where British immigrants could settle and spare Nauvoo the task of trying to accommodate them. Richard's sojourn in Warren ended after about 4 months, partly because of the harping criticisms of Warsaw Signal editor Thomas Sharp, who dubbed the settlement Money Diggersville. Smith called Richards back to church headquarters, and the First Presidency pulled the plug on the Warren Project altogether. On December 11, 1841, as Richards was returning to Nauvoo, Joseph Smith held a late-night council meeting with the apostles in his newly finished red brick store. Richards may have arrived too late to attend the meeting, for he recorded in his journal only that he stopped at new store. 2 days later, the prophet appointed Richards as both his private secretary and recorder for the Nauvoo Temple. The secretarial position immediately positioned Richards as Smith's closest confidant, and as a result of that, their friendship increased dramatically. Smith provided Richards with an office inside the store, and the new secretary began his duties the day of his appointment by recording an entry in Smith's diary, the first for the prophet after a gap of 2 years. The meeting between Smith and the 12 may well have included discussion of plural marriage, because earlier that day, Smith entered into his third polygamous union in Nauvoo. He inaugurated the practice there 8 months earlier in April 1841, when he married 26-year-old Louisa Beeman. His second plural union occurred 6 months later in October, when he married 20-year-old Zina Huntington Jacobs. On December 11th, the day he met with the 12 in his store for the first time, he married Priscindia Huntington Buell, age 31. Zion and Priscindia were sisters. Both were still married to other men at the time. Thus, these two unions were Joseph's first polyandrous sealings. The marriage of Zina was performed with the consent of Henry Jacobs, her civil husband of 7 months. Priscindia's husband, Norman Buell, whom she had married in January 1827, had left the church and was not aware of Smith's marriage to his wife for 14 years. Joseph's focus on polyandry continued into 1842, with the exception of Agnes Culbris Smith, widow of Joseph's brother, Don Carlos. The seven women he married between mid-January and April already had living husbands with whom they continued to cohabit. Because Richards and most of the 12 were still serving missions in England, in the spring of 1841, when Smith began practicing polygamy, Smith confided his activities in others, but only a select few. John C. Bennett was apparently one of them, and later, as an avowed enemy of Smith, exposed it publicly. Brigham Young and other members of the 12 began arriving back in Nauvoo in June 1841, and Smith began introducing them to plural marriage shortly thereafter. Richards learned about it sometime after his own arrival in Nauvoo in August, but just when remains unknown. The apostles who were in Nauvoo likely all knew about it by the December 11th meeting. Neither Smith, Richards, nor anyone else who had been taken into Smith's inner circle spoke about it publicly or wrote openly about it. The first to refer to the Smith-Beeman marriage was John C. Bennett, who wrote 18 months after the marriage and 4 months after leaving the church, "Joe Smith was privately married to his spiritual wives, Miss L. B., by Elder Joseph Bates Noble." Noble later confirmed that he had indeed performed this marriage. Willard Richards' initial response to Joseph Smith's new doctrine is unknown. However, Smith found in Richards a loyal follower, one not motivated by ecclesiastical ambitions. Richards' submissive personality was an appeal to Smith at this juncture, especially after Smith's disastrous relationship with Bennett, which began waning and ended in May 1842. Because Richards' family was still living in Massachusetts, Richards could devote his full time to the prophet. Joseph would have had little reason to teach Richards and other close associates about plural marriage if he hadn't expected them to take up the practice themselves. Most of them did so, although not without some reservations. For example, Apostle Heber C. Kimball relented only after Smith warned him 3 times that noncompliance would cost him his apostleship. Kimball tried to make it easier on his legal wife, Vallade, by agreeing to marry two of Vallade's friends, sisters Laura and Abigail Pitkin, both single and middle-aged. Smith disapproved, however, and intervened by urging Kimball to marry 31-year-old Sarah Peake Noon instead. Sarah was a British convert and recent immigrant, along with her family, to Nauvoo. However, her husband left her and returned to England shortly thereafter. Sarah Noon and Kimball married without Valete's knowledge in early 1842, probably in January. The question about whether Sarah was legally divorced seems to have been of small importance, writes Kimball's biographer, Stanley B. Kimball. Some church leaders at that time considered civil marriage by non-Mormon clergymen to be as unbinding as their baptisms. Sarah bore a child with Kimball the following December. The next recognized instance of plural marriage after Kimball's came 5 months later in June 1842 when Brigham Young married his first plural wife. There's some indication that between December 1841 and February 1842 that Willa Richards began the practice himself. The sources are inconclusive but warrant discussion here. The woman in question was Nancy Marinda Johnson Hyde, wife of Apostle Orson Hyde. If Marinda and Willard did marry, the union ended only after a few months because Marinda was subsequently sealed with Joseph Smith in April 1842. Since April 15, 1840, Orson had been away from Nauvoo serving missions in England and Palestine. He would not return to Nauvoo until December 1842 after an absence of 32 months. On December 2, 1841, after Marinda had been struggling alone for 20 months, Joseph Smith received a revelation concerning her well-being. Verily thus saith the Lord unto you, my servant Joseph, that inasmuch as you have called upon me to know my will concerning my handmaid, Nancy Marinda Hyde, behold, it is my will that she should have a better place prepared for her than that in which she now lives, in order that her life may be spared unto her. Therefore go and say unto my servant Ebenezer Robinson, and to my handmaid his wife, let them open their doors and take her and her children into their home and take care of them faithfully and kindly until my servant Orson Hyde returns from his mission or until some other provision can be made for her welfare and safety. Marinda was then told to hearken to the counsel of my servant Joseph in all things whatsoever he shall teach her, and it shall be a blessing upon her and upon her children after her unto her justification, saith the Lord. Robinson immediately moved Marinda into his home at the Times and Seasons building. The first reference to an association of any kind between Willard and Marinda occurred a few weeks later on Christmas Eve when they attended a dinner together for the apostles at the home of Hiram and Sarah Kimball. When Richards wrote of the evening's festivities in his journal, his reference to Marinda's presence was vague, but Wilford Woodruff noted specifically in his diary that Richards waited on Sister Hyde. Todd Compton, while not dismissing the possibility of a marriage between the two, believed that the secrecy regarding Nauvoo polygamy was so tight that Richards would probably not accompany his plural wife to a Christmas party. Yet by December 1842, Nauvoo polygamy was in its infancy, had only been practiced by Joseph Smith, and rumors regarding it hadn't yet surfaced. If there was a relationship between Willard and Marinda, it may have been only just begun. Thus, an appearance together would have listed little notice. Because both of their legal spouses were away from Nauvoo at the time, their accompanying each other to the dinner party, or to the dinner, may have been perceived simply as convenient. On January 13, 1842, Richards left his lodgings at Brigham Young's residence, where he had been living since he came to Nauvoo, and moved in with Joseph Smith. This move created an even greater degree of intimacy between Richards and the prophet. 2 weeks later, on January 28th, Smith received another revelation that would directly affect both Willard and Marinda. Verily thus saith the Lord unto you, my servant Joseph, go and say unto the 12 that it is my will to have them take in hand the editorial department of the Times and Seasons, according to that manifestation which shall be given unto them by the power of my Holy Spirit, in the midst of their council, saith the Lord. Amen. According to Ebenezer Robinson, the 12 acted upon the revelation on February 4th. Richards, acting on Smith's behalf, bought the building and everything inside, forcing Robinson to leave his editorship of the times and seasons, as well as his home. I'll grab a drink here. Reflecting back on this in 1890, nearly 50 years after the event, Robinson recalled that the transfer was made in the dead of winter, and the day I gave the deed, I was required to give possession. Although he was unable to find a new residence on such short notice, it made no difference. Just before night, I notified Willard Richards that they would need to give me a little more time to find a place to move. He replied, "You must get out tonight, or I will put you in the street." According to Robinson, Richards had his own plans for the times and seasons living quarters. That evening, Willard Richards nailed down the windows and fired off his revolver in the street after dark and commenced living with Mrs. Nancy Miranda Hyde in the rooms we had vacated in the printing office building, where they lived through the winter. His family was residing at the time in Massachusetts, and Elder Orson Hyde was absent on his mission to Palestine. Although Robinson reported this incident 5 decades later, he's accurate where the facts are not in dispute. Although Richards firing off a gun in the air as an act of celebration does not seem to fit his otherwise mild-mannered personality, he noted in an 1843 letter to Brigham Young that he was one who would do just that. "As you passed our office on the 7th, I discharged my last charge of powder and ball over your heads. Had no reason to reload, since all is peace." And I thank Michael Markort for pointing that out to me. I had the letter in my possession, but hadn't examined it yet. So I appreciate that. Michael, are you here? Oh, there you are. Okay, thank you for that. Although Robinson's reminiscences are late, rumors of a Richards-Hyde connection made their way to John C. Bennett around the time they would have begun. Bennett reported the relationship between the two in October 1842, just 8 months after the date given by Robinson, specifying when the couple allegedly began living together. Bennett referred to the printing office where Mrs. Hyde and Dr. Richards resided, and that Bennett had long suspected Richards as being up to his eyes in the business with Joe. He concludes his reference to Willard and Miranda by referring Riley to Dr. Richards, who is so notorious for hiding in these last days. Hiding being spelled H-Y-D-E-I-N-G. Cindy Rigdon, Smith's first counselor in the First Presidency, reported a Willard Richards-Miranda Hyde relationship 3 years after Bennett in a letter published in March 1845, which is 6 months after Rigdon's excommunication and subsequent move to Pittsburgh. Rigdon never accepted Smith's plural marriage teachings, even though he knew of at least some of them. He writes in his letter, "So, whatever we bind on earth is bound in heaven. So if Richard should take a notion to hide his wife in his absence, all that is necessary to be done is to be sealed. No harm done, no adultery committed, only taking a little advantage of rights of priesthood. And after Richards has gone the round of dissipation with Hyde's wife, she is afterwards turned over to Smith, and thus the poor, silly woman becomes the actual dupe of two designing men, under the sanctimonious garb of rights of the royal priesthood." By the time of the Richards-Hyde marriage, if one occurred, Joseph Smith had already been and was still entering his own polyandrous unions. Therefore, polyandrous sealing involving Richards may well have been in step with where Smith envisioned polygamy heading, at least for the time being. Also, Smith had already pressured Heber C. Kimball into marrying a second wife without Kimball's first wife's consent, at around the same time Richards would have been courting Miranda. So spousal knowledge was not an issue at that moment either. When Smith married Miranda Hyde himself in April 1842, it was without Orson Hyde's knowledge. He was still serving his mission overseas. With that in mind, Smith would have been even less concerned that Janetta Richards was not in the mood to approve a union between her husband and Miranda. In fact, Janetta's absence made Richards a safer candidate for putting Smith's teachings into practice than any of Smith's other close associates. A letter from Willard to Janetta, written in late February 1842, reveals Richards' enthusiastic acceptance of what is without question a plural marriage. This letter was written just 3 weeks after the date that Ebenezer Robinson said that Willard began living with Miranda Hyde. Now, to understand this, it's important to look ahead to an episode that occurred 6 weeks later when Willard and Miranda helped facilitate Smith's attempt to marry Nancy Rigdon, Sidney Rigdon's daughter. At the same time, it helps authenticate the letter Smith allegedly wrote to Nancy, which has generally been accepted as genuine, but which is occasionally still disputed. Although most of the details of the Joseph Smith-Nancy Rigdon episode come from John C. Bennett in his sensational expose, they do so only 3 months after Smith's alleged proposal. Also, many aspects of the story were later confirmed by others, both friend and foe to Smith. In a letter written on July 2, 1842 for the Sangamo Journal and published July 15th, Bennett claimed that Smith asked for his assistance in procuring Nancy Rigdon as a plural wife, but that Bennett refused to be a party to it. Therefore, Smith devised a new plan. On April 9th, Miranda Hyde approached Nancy Rigdon at the funeral of 24-year-old Ephraim Marks, who was the son of the Nauvoo State President, William Marks, and informed her that Smith wanted to see her on special business at the Times and Seasons building. When Nancy arrived, Smith was away working at his store, but Richards was there. "Miss Nancy," Richards said, "Joseph cannot come in today. Please call again on Thursday." Nancy next went to see her boyfriend, Francis M. Higby, and sought his advice on the matter. Bennett said he learned of this and approached Smith and urged him to be careful. Bennett then went to Higby and warned him of Smith's intent and encouraged him to go to Nancy and warn her of the infernal plot. Higby conveyed this to Nancy, and she went as scheduled. Joe was there and took her into a private room, locked the door, and commenced by telling her that he had long loved her and had asked the Lord for her, and that it was his holy will that he should have her. When he then tried to kiss her, Nancy rejected Smith's advances and threatened to alarm the neighbors if he did not open the door and let her out. Smith obliged, but Miranda Hyde soon went to Nancy and tried to persuade her to reconsider. Plural marriage had looked strange to her, Miranda, at first, but she, Nancy, would become more reconciled on mature reflection. Miss Rigdon replied, "I never shall." In a final attempt to persuade Nancy to marry him, according to Bennett, Smith dictated a letter to her through Richards. "That letter is now safe in the hands of her friends. I have seen it, so has her father, and various other persons," insisted Bennett. Smith later went to the Rigdon home, where he denied that any advances or attempts to marry Nancy had occurred. But she told him that he was a cursed liar and that he could not face her to it. Joe then made a full acknowledgement of the whole affair. All the family and many other persons were present. Bennett wrote a total of 6 letters to the Sangamo Journal. That containing the account of the Nancy Rigdon episode was his second. In his 6th, published in the August 19, 1842 issue, he produced a transcription of the letter that had been referred to earlier as Smith's letter to Nancy Rigdon, being in Richard's handwriting. The letter begins, and I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of this, "Happiness is the object and design of our existence, and will be to the end thereof, if we pursue the path that leads to it. And this path is virtue, uprightness, faithfulness, holiness, and keeping all the commandments of God." Then, to justify his marriage proposal, Smith said, "That which is wrong under one circumstance may be, and often is, right under another. God said, 'Thou shalt not kill.' At another time, he said, 'Thou shalt utterly destroy.' This is the principle on which the government of heaven is conducted, by revelation, adapted to the circumstances in which the children of the kingdom are placed. Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason thereof till long after the events transpire. If we seek first the kingdom of God, all good things will be added. So was Solomon. First he asked wisdom, and God gave it to him, and with it every desire of his heart, even things which might be considered abominable to all who understand the order of heaven, only in part, but which in reality were right, because God gave and sanctified by special revelation." News about Smith's proposal to Nancy Rigdon began spreading throughout Nauvoo, and according to a later reminiscence of John Rigdon, Nancy's brother, it became the talk of the town that Joseph had made a proposition to Nancy to become his wife, and that she refused him. According to one of Rigdon's sons, bad feeling existed between Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon, and they did not often meet, although they lived only a few rods from each other and did not seem to be on very friendly terms. On July 20th, the Wasp published a piece signed by 20 citizens of Nauvoo who swore to the high moral character of Joseph Smith. Rigdon, along with George W. Robinson and Orson Pratt, who were also aware of this and other situations, refused to sign it. However, Rigdon shortly submitted a letter to the Wasp, dated August 27th, declaring that, "I am fully authorized by my daughter Nancy to say to the public, through the medium of your paper, that the letter, which has appeared in the Sangamo Journal, making part of General Bennett's letters of said paper to said paper, purporting to have been written by Mr. Smith to her, was unauthorized by her, and that she never said to General Bennett or any other person that said letter was written by Mr. Smith, nor in his handwriting, but by another person's handwriting." Rigdon does not deny or even address the accuracy of Bennett's story, but only writes that Nancy never at any time authorized General Bennett to use her name in the public papers as he has done, which has been greatly to the wounding of her feelings. Did the happiness letter originate with Joseph Smith? The original has never been found. The key to this issue, I believe, comes in the letter that Richard wrote to his wife, Janetta, in February 1842. Richard's journal entries during the first 5 months in Nauvoo reveal that he sent Janetta one letter per month at roughly around the same time each month, September 20th, October 19th, November 30th, and December 19th, 1841, and also on September 22nd, 1842. A gap exists in Richard's personal diary between January 23rd and July 1st, 1842. So dates for letters he sent Janetta during that five-month period are unknown, except for the one he wrote on February 26th, because it survives. Another also survives, but it is undated, and it's not clear from the contents if it was written before or after the February 26th letter. Unfortunately, none of Janetta's letters to her husband during this time have surfaced, but from the two surviving letters from Willard, it is clear that Janetta was lonely, involved in conflicts with Willard's sisters in Massachusetts, and feared that she might become tempted toward infidelity, and was suffering from a wavering faith. Willard indicates in his final journal entry before the gap, dated January 22nd, that he interpreted a dream and mailed a letter to Janetta. For this reason, I assign the undated letter to January 22nd, because he writes of a dream had by Janetta. "My dearest Janetta, I am sorry you did not understand the interpretation of your dream. The statement was that you would be tempted, not that you would give way and wrong me or break your vow. No, and instead of my believing you guilty of any criminal act, I never had a jealous thought of you, God knows. No, never. The interpretation was from God as a warning to beware of temptation. Therefore, set your heart at rest about my fears of you. I am sorry you should ever have had any feelings you have experienced about it. Banish them. There is no occasion. I believe you would rather die than do wrong in such a matter. But the devil is cunning, and all are liable to temptation, Jesus not excepted. And the dream you mentioned in your last is not good, neither is it from a good source, so you need not give yourself any uneasiness about it." Regarding some conflicts between Janetta and Willard's sisters, Rhoda and Nancy, he adds, "My sisters are not your enemies, and I perceive by your letter you do not count them as such. I am glad to see your feelings are kind towards them. I am aware that you and they have not understood each other's feelings and movements and wishes. I do not believe there is any enmity between you." Now, were Janetta's dreams and temptations about infidelity a response to something Willard told her about the doctrine of polygamy, perhaps his own? This conclusion certainly cannot be reached from this letter, but in his February 26th letter, Willard refers to polygamy in a veiled manner, and it is not clear whether or not Janetta is here learning about it for the first time. "If you will cling to me and seek my happiness to the end, I will bring you into the kingdom and your friends and mine. There are many things recorded of the old patriarchs and prophets which have seemed bad to us. which if we knew the reason thereof and the order of God, would appear right. Willard then confirmed his unique relationship with the prophet, which he hoped would buy him some time before he left Nauvoo to receive Janetta. Joseph says he has been searching all his lifetime to find a man after his own heart, in all things, that he can trust with his business, and he has found him. Who do you think it is? Dr. Richards. Will this not compensate for the loss of his company a little while, my love? Then, in what is another reference to plural marriage, he says, I want to bring this up. Which one do I click here? Well, I'll do it from here. Okay. I love my sisters as well as ever, and my Janetta better too. And if I had 1,000 such dear friends, I could love them all. Why? Because my heart is true, expansive as eternity. Could I see you, I could explain many things I did not know when I left you. The grand secret of the gospel is this, for us to live by every word of the Lord, to live by revelation, present revelation, do what God requires of us and not what he required of somebody else. If you will do right in all things, God will show you many things by his Spirit. Now, similarities between Smith's purported letter to Nancy Ridman, said to have been written in Richard's hand, and Richard's February 26th letter to Janetta are clear. And Joseph's letter to Nancy Ridman says, that which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another. And Willard to Janetta, to live by revelation, present revelation, do what God requires of us and not what he required of somebody else. What was that?
I don't know.
Oh. It's, hopefully nothing. It'll continue. Yeah. And then, also, in Joseph's letter to Nancy Rigdon, whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason thereof till long after the events transpire. I think that's my phone, actually. And then in his letter to Janetta, there are many things recorded of the old patriarchs and prophets which have seemed bad to us, which if we knew the reason thereof and the order of God would appear right. It is clear from Willard's letter to Janetta that he was familiar with language and concepts that found their way into the Nancy Rigdon letter, and it helps to verify its authenticity. The Nancy Rigdon letter, on the other hand, helps confirm that Willard was referring to plural marriage in this letter to Janetta. The Nancy Rigdon letter became generally accepted as authentic in time. A copy exists in Joseph Smith's letter book under the heading Joseph Smith's Letter to Nancy Rigdon, and it is assigned a date of January 1842. If that date is correct, then Richards would already have dictated it before writing Janetta in February, despite the fact that it wasn't given to Nancy Rigdon until April. Other sources indicate that it wasn't written before April 9th because the happiness reference was meant to mirror similar phrases used by Sidney Rigdon in his sermon at the funeral of Ephraim Marks, delivered the day Miranda Hyde first approached Nancy Rigdon about meeting with Joseph Smith. If the Rigdon letter was not written until the time Joseph first began proposing to Nancy, then Smith may have already been using such language and concepts when teaching and convincing the 12 to accept the doctrine, and that this language was also used to persuade Nancy as well. In 1855, the letter was entered into the manuscript history of the church under the date of August 19, 1842, the date the Sangamo Journal published it as part of John C. Bennett's six-letter expose. It's clear also that Richard's February 26 letter to Janetta, that in the letter, that he had enthusiastically accepted the idea of plural marriage and wanted to prepare Janetta for the practice, even at a time that she was enduring both loneliness and a wavering faith, which would typically not be a good time. It was not a good time. If Richards believed that if he had 1,000 such friends, dear friends, he could love them all because his heart is true, expansive as eternity, it seems to me that he was basing this on not simply on a theory, but something he knew from experience. Obviously, I cannot conclude this definitively, but on March 8th, 10 days later, after 10 days after writing Janetta, Willard performed his first plural marriage ceremony, this to, from Joseph Smith to Patty Bartlett Sessions. By late spring, Janetta's loneliness had taken its toll. It was probably around mid-June that Joseph Smith received a letter from her in which she wanted some answers, and she wanted them from him. Janetta's letter to Smith does not survive, but it's clear in brief references to it in Smith's response, dated June 23, 1842, that she accused Smith of keeping Willard too busy to fetch her. Joseph assured her that Willard was a man in whom I have the most implicit confidence and trust. You say I have got him? So I have, in the which I rejoice, for he has done me a great good and taken a great burden off of my shoulders since his arrival in Nauvoo. Never did I have greater intimacy with any man than with him. Smith assured Janetta that Willard would be on his way to Massachusetts in a few days to bring her to Nauvoo. As Willard had done before him, Joseph tried to prepare Janetta for some new doctrines. I want you to be a general in this matter, in helping him along, which I know you will. He will be able to teach you many things which you never have heard. You will have implicit confidence in the same. On Friday, July 1st, Richards left Nauvoo and arrived in Richmond, Massachusetts, 2 weeks later on July 14th. One can only imagine Janetta's joy in reuniting with her husband after an absence of a year. The reunion was tempered, however, when Willard found Janetta still suffering from severe illness. After a week reuniting with family and friends in Berkshire County, Willard and Janetta left Heber John in the care of Willard's brother, William, on July 20th, and the next day they started for New York, where Willard was to raise money for the Nauvoo Temple. However, his mission expanded into one of damage control in the wake of John C. Bennett's very public anti-Mormon lecture tour. At least twice, Richards ran into Bennett in the street. Richards' presence was working because Bennett left New York after learning that Richards was in the city. Richards also talked to at least two newspaper editors ahead of Bennett's visits to New York and Boston in order to minimize coverage of Bennett's upcoming lectures. After Richards finished with Bennett, he and Janetta returned to Richmond, packed up Heber John, and headed to Nauvoo. Richards' journal indicates that they stopped in St. Louis on October 26th. It was on this date, according to one of his descendants, that Richards talked with Stephen Longstroth, a British convert he had known in England, and asked permission to marry two of Longstroth's daughters. 4 days later, the Richards arrived in Nauvoo. On January 18, 1843, the Longstroths visited Nauvoo, where Willard Richards married 16-year-old Sarah Longstroth and her 14-year-old sister, Nanny. The marriages were performed by Joseph Smith. Whatever had occurred between Richards and Marinda Hyde the year before, the 1843 marriages marked Richards' officially recognized initiation into polygamy. The Longstroths returned to St. Louis following the marriages, and according to a granddaughter, neither marriage was consummated until after the family moved to Nauvoo and the unions were solemnized in the Nauvoo Temple on January 22, 1846. That same day, Willard was sealed by proxy to Janetta, who had died the previous July. By February 6, 1846, Brigham Young had sealed Richards to all nine of Richards' Nauvoo plural wives. Janetta was only 27 years old when she died in July 1845. Her surviving letters indicate that in addition to physical ailments and loneliness, she also suffered from depression. On March 26, 3 months before Janetta's death, the family sat for daguerreotype artist Lucien Foster in Nauvoo. Richard's previous biographer, Claire Nawal, noted, "The Nauvoo picture shows Willard and his neckerchief slightly awry, his hair somewhat tumbled, a crease between his brow, a worried look on his face. Janetta in this picture appears sad. Her little boy is standing close to her, and she has her arm around Willard's shoulder, as though to say, he is mine." Heber John always maintained that his mother died of a broken heart. The story of Willard Richards and Nauvoo polygamy leaves questions, including the exact nature of relationships, unanswered. Yet it does show that whatever occurred, Richards' actions were motivated by his devotion to Joseph Smith and his willingness to consecrate his time to the prophet and embrace his most controversial teachings. Both came at Janetta's expense. However, not only during the year-long absence when the couple was separated, when Janetta was in Massachusetts, but after they began residing together in Nauvoo. Richards found justification as well as comfort from the words of Jesus that he that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. For Willard Richards is extended to wives, but he firmly believed that by following the prophet, he was about his father's business. The story of Willard and Janetta Richards is a shared one, to be sure, but in important aspects, their individual stories differ dramatically. Unfortunately, Janetta's story may never really be told. Thank you.
One of the hallmarks of historical research and writing is that every generation of historians can look at well-known evidence in new ways, explore the significance of little-known evidence, and reveal evidence that has been unrecognized for years, for decades, even for centuries. This is why history is fundamentally different from the past, which is complete and unchanging. Correspondingly, among the frustrations of history as a discipline is that it does change, and that there is often never enough surviving evidence from the past to clarify, let alone answer, nagging questions about events and people in the past. Historical research and analysis try to assemble a jigsaw puzzle that has no borders, that has a partially discernible image, and that has a very small percentage of its original pieces, some of which are damaged. For example, polygamous ideas, teachings, practices, and participants in Nauvoo, Illinois during the 1840s provide an abundance of nagging questions, few contemporary sources, and only a limited amount of reminiscent sources, all of which must be analyzed within a swirling cauldron of biases. The answers or lack of answers about Nauvoo polygamy can enlighten, puzzle, depress, amuse, repel, inspire, shock, anger, and frustrate, sometimes all at once, and other times like a roller coaster. Those responses can be found among believers in Mormonism and its unbelievers, among historians and non-academics, among religious leaders and the rank and file, among descendants of the participants and those who have no horse in the race. Devery Anderson has jumped into this predicament with a paper that undoubtedly has produced many of the responses I've mentioned. It's an excellent presentation that combines familiar sources and events with unfamiliar ones and provides new interpretations of old problems. He repeats the oft-cited sources about Marinda Nancy Johnson Hyde's alleged relationship with Willard Richards from December 1841 to the spring of 1842, but presents it as a mirror image of the acknowledged ceremonies that united Joseph Smith with already married women, including Marinda herself, in April 1842. Completely new to me, however, was Devery's citation of Willard's letter that verified what I'd always seen as a problem in Ebenezer Robinson's reminiscence decades later, the claim that Apostle Richards fired a revolver in the streets of Nauvoo when he felt like celebrating. Furthermore, although the crucial correspondence of Willard Richards with his wife, Janetta, has been in the Church History Library for a long time, I never looked at it during my decades of research there. That was my loss, and Devery's use of it today is your gain. He skillfully teases out meanings and insights from the letters. I think the most important are the parallels and ideas and phrasing to the 1842 letter on happiness. Garrett John Dirkmott, one of the researcher writers for the Joseph Smith Papers Project, has publicly expressed skepticism about this often quoted letter as a genuine expression by the prophet. However, because it was described in 1842-45 as being in the handwriting of Willard Richards, Devery's findings are a crucial rebuttal to that criticism, not proof, but important support for the genuineness that the church's leaders didn't reference when they published the letter in Joseph Smith's official history more than a century ago. The Richards correspondence about his wife's dream is truly fascinating and revealing. However, Devery's dating of it as 22 January 1842 is an error. That's the date he mailed his interpretation of the dream to her, after receiving a description of it in her now-missing letter from Massachusetts. According to the slowness of overland mail delivery in 1842, his letter of January 22nd with his interpretation took at least 3 weeks to reach Janetta in Massachusetts, and there was a similar delay for her response from there to reach him in Nauvoo. Therefore, his undated letter, a reply to her response, had to be in March 1842. Historians love debating chronology. Nevertheless, Devery Anderson has provided a new window onto the controversial past of Nauvoo, of Joseph Smith, of Marinda Hunt, of Willard Richards, and Janetta Richards. Thank you.
Could somebody turn the lights on, please? We have about 15 minutes, a little less, for questions. So I don't know if that microphone works in the middle, but you might step to that. Thank you. If you want to just make your questions short, I'll repeat them, or whoever you address the question to can repeat them on the microphone. Any questions? Go.
Devery, the photo, I liked your analysis, and actually it was quite thought-provoking, by the whole way, the paper, fantastic paper. Rick Render had made the comment to me one time that he thought that actually that's one of the most provocative photos for a 19th century photo. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
These lines.
Okay.
That should work, yeah.
Okay. Oh, thanks. I'd have to. You mean like in Mormonism or anywhere?
No, he was, you know, because Rick deals with photos across all 19th century cultures. So.
Well, he would know more along those lines than me, but I'd never seen one like it anywhere. And I don't know how often you see a wife sitting on a husband's lap
in the 19th century. That was Rick's point, he had never seen one.
And Bill Slaughter has talked about that too in his book. What was his book? Life in Zion, I think.
Oh, yeah, right.
He talks about that, and I understand he's done a lot of work on this as well and has studied a lot of photographs, and he found it, you know, unique. So I would say yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'd like to both comment on this. My question perhaps goes a little bit beyond the scope of the paper this morning, but overall, what can you both comment on John C. Bennett's accusations and how accurate most of them were?
He's asking about John C. Bennett's accusation and how accurate they were.
Well, I think the ones that we touched on as far as talking about Joseph Smith and his, what he said is called spiritual wives, and he mentions a few instances where Joseph Smith made proposals and that. And he mentions his marriage to Miss L.B. And one thing that George Smith pointed out in his book on Nauvoo Polygamy is that the L is followed by several asterisks as well as the B, and they both correspond to the correct number of letters in Louisa Beeman's name. And he also said that the marriage was performed by Joseph Bates Noble, and Joseph Noble later confirmed that he did perform that. So that instance is certainly correct. The happiness letter, I think, we can assume now is an actual transcription of a letter. He said it was in Willard Richards' handwriting. Richards was living with Joseph Smith at the time, was his scribe, so I don't see how it could have been in anybody else's handwriting. Joseph wasn't writing his own stuff at that point, and the fact that it was Willard, I think, was it had to be. So there are instances there. I mean, obviously he had an agenda, and he was willing to say things that I think universally people regard him as a scoundrel. But there's clearly things that he, you know, passed on about his experience in Nauvoo that were based on truth, but, you know, wherever he exaggerated those or made things up beyond that, or certainly there's always, I think we can all acknowledge that he did that. I don't know if you have other thoughts on that.
Well,
Bennett's letters, then later published in his History of the Saints, are this mixture of verifiable truths and facts, as well as his flights of fancy, as well as his very self-serving concealment. One of the funny things, I mean, funny in the sense of the backstory, is his account of Nancy Rigdon and his asking the Chauncey Higby to rush to her defense and her virtue. Chauncey Higby and John C. Bennett, for a year before the proposal to Nancy Rigdon, had been seducing women, and we know this by the testimony of these women to the Nauvoo High Council. And it was not just simply seducing them for a one-on-one relationship. Higby and Bennett both taught these women that it didn't matter how many men they had sex with, because if John C. Bennett sent the men to these women, then it was good in the eyes of God. So for Bennett to express this, I'm shocked, reminding me of Casablanca, about plural marriage in Nauvoo, and then to claim that he was using Chauncey Higby to defend Nancy Rigdon's virtue is hilarious. If you think of it in terms of what the backstory was. Also, his claims about the Cloisters sisters and all of these 3 degrees of promiscuity in Utah is based on 2 things. One, he's doing a dystopic parallel to the 3 degrees of glory. But he, in doing it with regard to sexuality and inventing these 3 degrees of sexual perversion in his, as he presents it in Nauvoo. If anyone was guilty of that, it was John C. Bennett. So you have this mixture of his concealment of what he was actually doing with people like Chauncey Higby, and also his invention of things that just simply did not exist, plus his verifiable accuracy. Devery mentioned only the list of wives with regard to Louisa Beeman. Every one of the wives he listed with these asterisk marks that applies to the full name, the letters of their full name, every one of them was later verified by participants as accurate, not to support Bennett, but that became the unintended consequence of these affidavits years later by these people as participants in pre-1844 polygamy. So you have these 3 levels of assessing Bennett's, and of course, in some areas, we don't know, we don't have evidence. We only have our conclusions as individuals of whether this is an invention or whether this is accurate. And one of the examples that I'm not going to get into, but if you know it, you know what I'm referring to, is a letter that he allegedly quotes from Old White Hat to a woman in Nauvoo who was known to be a prostitute in Nauvoo. And again, because there is no independent confirmation one way or the other, and because certain elements of his allegation are historically valid, there was such a woman, then it depends on whether you think he was capable of consorting with a known prostitute, or whether you think that was, like some of the other issues of Bennett's allegations, sheer invention.
Devery, I was interested in your establishment of the relationship between the 2 letters. And I've always assumed that Joseph influenced Willard. Is it possible that the happiness concept was actually Willard's and Joseph picked it up from him?
That's interesting. I never thought of it quite like that, because I see, I guess my conclusion, I guess, has been kind of what I said in there, that this was probably just the concepts in that, I don't think, in the letter didn't originate when he sent the letter, when he was writing Nancy specifically. I think the same language could conceivably have been used to convince the 12 that this came from God, that this, you know, what God required at one time was right, and that. But that's good. I'd like to think Willard could have done that, because I think that would certainly enhance him a little bit. What I've learned from studying Willard Rich's life is just the degree of intimacy between the two men, which you associate him as an apostle, as a historian, and as president of Carthage Jail, but their relationship was deeper than that. And that's something that I would love to be able to explore, but I don't know if there's anything else that could lead me to that, but that's a good question. But I've just assumed that that originated with Joseph. Willard had written the letter, or was aware of the language, and used that to persuade Janetta as well.
Debbie, when do you think your book will be out? You have any idea?
Well, now...
He's only been working on it for over 10 years.
Well, more than that, I was looking through my call slips recently, and I saw that my first trip to the archives to do with anything with Willard Richards was in the summer of 1995. So that's been a while now, but I have been interrupted by a few other projects, so I can blame it on that. But I've made some great progress this year. I think I'll have a draft done within the year, and then however long it takes to get it ready to go from there. But I'm working on it. I've done more in the last 8 months than I have in the last 10 years, probably. So,
okay.
I couldn't follow the implication of the March dating on the letter. I can't remember what the date was for the happiness letter. So, what's the implication of that?
Oh, it had no connection to the happiness letter. It's just the internal dating of the letter.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Mr. Why?
That question was my little dispute about the data, his dating of the undated letter as being in January has nothing to do with the happiness letter. It just relates to that letter in itself, in that the sequence of events as I see them require that the undated letter occurred in March, but that has no connection with any of the other actors and characters and events that Devery was talking about, aside from the issue of the dream, the interpretation of the dream, her very negative response to his interpretation, and then this undated letter's response to her response to his interpretation.
Yes, what?
Just to follow up on one of your throwaway lines, Devery, is there any evidence from the Quorum of the Twelve that that same happiness argument was used in discussions of polygamy? Does Willard mention it? Does Lucy
Kimball? I've not seen it anywhere else, and the only thing that made me think that could be the case is because the happiness letter, it's deposited, it's in Joseph Smith's letter book as well as the manuscript history of the church. In the letter book, it's dated January, which was 3 months before the Nancy Reagan thing. So if it was written then, like it says there, then that was already floating around, at least before. But if it was dated April, then, you know, it puts a different light on it, with Willard knowing about using that language 2 months ahead of that. So I want to say,
question, why don't you come over here and use this mic?
That's okay, I can talk out.
I did want to say one thing, because when Mike mentioned that he hadn't seen these letters before, I thought I had found all this stuff, but when volume 2 of the Joseph Smith papers of the journals came out recently, it quotes this February 26th letter, just where Joseph Smith is saying Willard was a man after his own heart and that. And I thought, where did this letter come from? I'd never seen this. So I went and found it, and there was a pretty new transcript of it, as well as the original in a plastic sleeve. And I don't know when the church acquired these, but I don't know, maybe it wasn't all that long ago, because the two letters were together in their own manuscript file. So I was glad to find them, so thank you, Joseph Smith Papers, because that helped a lot in this case. So, and I'm sorry,
This is a subjective question that admits of no real definitive answer, but over the past 20 years, I've become convinced that Joseph Smith really was a very lonely man carrying the mantle of a prophet. I've come to the conclusion that he didn't have many really close friends, maybe Hiram being the closest. But where would you place Willard Richards in this spectrum of closeness to Joseph Smith? Like I say, it's a screwy question, and it won't admit of any definitive answer, but give me your opinion.
Well, I think just what Joseph Smith said to Janetta in his letter, that never have I had greater intimacy with any man than with him. And then when Willard describes to Janetta in his letter to her what Joseph had said, that he'd never found a man, he was a man after his own heart, and he's never been able to trust anybody with his business, personal business, as with Willard. I think his relationship with Willard was closer than anybody. Now, again, he was the one, he and John Taylor, the ones who accompanied him to Carthage as well, and Willard talks about how he would have been willing to do anything for Joseph. And I think James Arlington Bennett, when he described Willard in his own letter to Joseph Smith, he called him his most devoted follower. And I think for Joseph, it was a relief to have someone like Willard, because he'd formed a close bond with Sidney Rigdon, and they had begun to have problems. He adopted ideas and doctrines, I think, that Sidney had prior to his conversion to Mormonism. They had their falling outs, and that I think that it could be argued easily that they were in somewhat competition with each other. Same with John C. Bennett. Joseph became immediately enamored with him, and that turned out disastrous. And I think when Willard came along, he saw someone who was devoted, that unconditionally devoted to him. That after Rigdon and Bennett, I think he learned a lesson as far as what kind of person to adopt into his inner circle, and I think Willard fit that. And so I think, and plus, doing the research I've done, I think that I can safely say that his association with him was probably greater than anyone's. He was his secretary until his death as well, and so in that time he resided with him in his home, I would love to have been a fly on the wall, and I would love to know what they talked about. I become more and more fascinated by their relationship all the time.
I think those are good concluding comments. I'm sorry, our time's up. But thank you very much for coming. I think they deserve another hand.